This is The Point on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. It is Friday, September 6th. This is our weekly local news roundup. We'll be discussing the week's top stories with reporters and editors from around the region. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from CAI's Jeanette Barnes. We'll check in with Denise Coffey of the Cape Cod Times and Sam Houghton of the Martha's Vineyard Times. We'll hear from Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle and Paul Benson of the Provincetown Independent. We'll speak with Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. CAI's Gilda Geis speaks with our State House correspondent Katie Lannon, and we'll hear from CAI's Eve Zuckoff. Now to some of the news around the Cape, the coast, and the islands. A new set of Massachusetts offshore wind contracts is expected to be announced today. And it's not just Massachusetts. This is the three-state bidding process that we've been following for more than a year. These are for new wind farms, which would go to the south of us. CAI's Jeanette Barnes is here to break the whole thing down and to talk about more of this week's news. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi, Steve.
First, give us a quick reminder of the basics of these wind contracts. Who's buying the power here and who's bidding?
Sure. So the buyers here are the retail electric companies whose names we all know, Eversource and National Grid. There's also a smaller one called Unitil. And the bidders for the contracts are the offshore wind developers. So the developers want to build the next wind farms that we'll see off our coast. And then the power companies and the state on their side want to get good prices, and they want to get some economic development from those projects. The retail power companies are involved in selecting which projects will get these contracts. But this time, the state really has the final word, which was not as much the case in the past. It's always been sort of a collaborative process. And the three states, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, and Connecticut, are all working together to choose regional level projects. So the actual contract language is still to come, but they're selecting here who will get to go on and negotiate those contracts for a wind farm.
Talk a little bit about the significance of this for the transition away from fossil fuels. Altogether, these wind farms could generate a lot of energy.
Yes. So the three states together are looking for 6,800 megawatts of power capacity in this round. At the size of turbines today, that is roughly 500 turbines. Although I should mention that the bids actually don't add up to that amount. They're a little less than that if you took all the bids together. They're about 5,500 megawatts compared to 6,800. But one data point that caught my eye in this whole thing is something Governor Healey said, which is that just the Massachusetts portion of the solicitation, 3,600 megawatts, could meet one quarter of the state's electricity demand. All that power is subject to how much the wind actually blows, but generating a quarter of the state's power really would be a notable moment. And of course, we know there's more wind capacity out there, both in this area that's south of the islands and then also off the Outer Cape.
This is unique in that it's a tri-state bidding process, but what does that really mean? How are the three states working together on this?
Well, they've all issued their own requests for proposals. How exactly they've been coordinating the selection of winning bidders is something that they've really kept pretty close to the vest. But what they have done is set the parameters for the wind farms in such a way that one project could fulfill the criteria for multiple states. So the result of that is that we're not talking about a project that is all Massachusetts or all Connecticut or all Rhode Island, but the bids show the companies went out of their way to make sure they were putting some type of economic development activity into more than one state. And generally, the big categories there are the staging of construction and then the operations and maintenance hub.
Mm. These landside economic benefits, we know they're a big part of what states and towns want from these contracts. So I guess, what are some of the specifics of which cities could get what?
Yes, well, again, keeping in mind we don't know which projects may be chosen or may be passed over, it looks like New Bedford will be getting a really noticeable amount of activity. Vineyard Wind 2 and New England Wind would be basing their operations and maintenance out of New Bedford. New England Wind also, though, is using Bridgeport, Connecticut for operations and maintenance. So that's some of that spreading the love. And then construction, staging of construction for at least two of the projects would go to the new offshore wind terminal that's up in Salem. So I won't go through the full list, but generally, a lot of the work here would go in New Bedford, Salem, and then a couple of ports in Connecticut.
Let's talk location. I know a lot of people listening are saying 500 turbines or something on that scale. Where are these all going to go? All of these wind projects could be located, they would be located in federal waters south and southwest of Martha's Vineyard in Nantucket, right?
Yeah, right. Generally, like 15 to 30-ish miles off the islands. This is kind of starts south of Newport and then goes over to Nantucket. And the westernmost project here is actually one that didn't bid in Massachusetts. They bid only in Rhode Island and Connecticut. But the turbines go in their lease area regardless. They've held these leases, which they bought by auction years ago. And the leasing thing is completely different, separate from whether they have a contract to actually sell the power.
It seems like the element of these offshore wind farms that's been the most controversial here on Cape Cod is the landing of electrical cables on the shore of the Cape. Tell us how the projects in this bidding process are handling that.
Right. Well, as far as I can tell, there are no plans for new landing locations on the Cape. Some of these projects are ones that were canceled and then revived, right? So everyone pretty much knows what the plan is here. The New England Wind 1 and 2, which are owned by Avangrid, are planning to land their cables at Craigville Beach and Dowses Beach in Barnstable. For the other wind farms in this bidding round, they're planning to land cables either at Brayton Point in Somerset or again in Connecticut.
And what we're learning about today is the selection of winning bidders, but the actual contracts are not complete. So what do we know about the pricing of the wind power they'll be offering?
The big question. The pricing information is redacted from the public version of these bids that has been, shared online. And in fact, some of the bids have very lengthy sections that are redacted. So we don't know what financial details they've presented. And you're correct that we are not seeing the actual contracts today. So what we're seeing is the projects that will be selected to move forward. But one thing we do know about pricing is that this time the prices can be indexed to inflation. Because when the wind companies last time canceled some of their contracts and had to pay actually tens of millions of dollars in penalties to get out of those contracts, they said it was because pricing costs had risen so much that they were not able to perform at the prices they agreed to.
Let's turn now to another story that you reported this week. This is about a worker being exposed to radiation at the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station. We first learned about this exposure in May, but now it's been confirmed by a federal inspection. Is that right?
That's right. So this originally came out in an anonymous letter that had been sent to local activists, and it was saying that a Pilgrim worker was exposed to enough radiation that the person set off an alarm in the building. And at the time when we reported on it, the owner of Pilgrim, Holtec, acknowledged that the incident had occurred. But what we have now is a federal inspection report issued in August. It says that what the worker was doing was performing a survey of the area underneath the head of the reactor vessel. So the head is kind of like a cap, and this is an area where there is a lot of radiation. It's a cramped space, and the person brushed against some kind of contaminated surface. Radiation went into the air. The person breathed it in. The federal agency that is in charge of nuclear plants, which is the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, said that in this situation, respiratory protection should have been used, and that the Pilgrim staff who were planning to do this work looked at the risks, but they used what the government calls non-conservative assumptions in their evaluation, and it turned out to yield the wrong answer here about, the need for protection.
And what do we know about how serious this exposure was? They're inhaling radiation.
Yes, well, they base it on millirems, a measurement of the radiation inhaled and externally. This person got 132 millirems internally plus 43 external. That is much lower than the limit the federal government sets for nuclear plant employees, but it's 50 times higher than for the general public. But the government says this is considered safe.
So the limit for nuclear plant employees is about 50 times higher than the exposure that's available to, or it's supposed to be allowed for the general public.
Yes, and then this is that's for an operating nuclear plant, and Sheehan from the NRC says that to even have a chance of that, you would have to stand next to the plant for like 24 hours a day or something like that. But yes.
So what's the consequence for Holtec, the company who's decommissioning the plant from this violation? What happens next?
Right. Well, I talked to the spokesman for the government commission about this, Neil Sheehan, and he says that the inspectors look for trends over time. If they see continuing violations like this, they can take more significant action. But for right now, essentially, they're going to follow up and make sure that a Pilgrim is correcting the problem.
That is CAI's Jeanette Barnes. Jeanette, thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you, Steve.
It was primary day in Massachusetts on Tuesday. Our region saw a few high-profile primary races. Denise Coffey of the Cape Cod Times is here to fill us in. Hi, Denise.
Good morning. How are you today?
We are doing well. Before we get to results, let's talk about voter turnout. Primaries can be a little bit sleepy. What do we know about how many people cast a ballot this time around on the Cape?
Well, it was very sleepy at all the polling stations the reporters were at Tuesday morning. In almost all cases, the poll workers outnumbered the voters. So, but let's give a shout out to the poll workers and the town clerks for doing such a good job. We had, I think, the 20.7% turnout in Chatham. So you're talking votes cast 1,269. That was our, these were the unofficial results I'm looking at. So that might have been a little bit of a change. But and then the biggest turnout that I had access to was 27% in Orleans, where 1,593 people cast their votes. Again, unofficial counts, those were early counts that I was working from. So not a big turnout, but everybody at every polling station, all the town clerks were saying, wait till November. Gonna be
Yes.
very different story.
I can imagine they're gaming that out now, how that's going to go. But also this time around, a lot of people vote by mail, I'm guessing, right?
Yes, significant number voting by mail. I think where did I go? I was in Harwich, and they had like 1,300 mail-in votes to count. That's significant.
Yeah, and you can imagine that makes it seem a little bit quieter at the polls on the day of the election. Let me ask you about some of the
Exactly.
races here. One of the primary races that did draw a lot of attention for the Democrats, the contest for the state representative seat for Barnstable, Dukes, and Nantucket counties. Two strong candidates here. Tell us about this race.
Well, yeah, you had Thomas Smokley and Ariel Faria.
Faria,
And
yes. Yeah.
Faria, I apologize. Smokley took Barnstable and Nantucket counties, but Faria took Dukes counties. I think Smokley won 56.7% of the vote. Faria took 43.3%. And again, I'm working off the unofficial results that I get early Tuesday. So anyway, and there's no Republican running against them. So it looks like Moakley's gonna be in.
And the official results actually don't get certified by Bill Galvin's office at the state for a while. So that's why when we say we're working off unofficial results, you're looking at polling numbers from the polling stations and the towns' reported numbers, just so people know what we're
Right.
talking about, right? The reason this seat is open here that Moakley appears to be headed to take in the next election in November because he won't have somebody standing against him. The reason that seat is open is because State Representative Dylan Fernandez has set his sights on the Plymouth and Barnstable State Senate seat, which was previously held by Sue Moran. Fernandez had no opponent in the primary in the Democratic side, but the Republicans held a very close race for the state Senate seat, one that may not be, I guess, officially decided for a little longer.
Yeah, I guess the count, excuse me, the count, the latest news I had, it had been 50 votes separating them, and the latest information I had was it was down to 48 votes separating them. Moratori was ahead by 50 or 48. But McCray is, she was out gathering signatures for a petition to recount. And that has, she has to have those petitions in by 5 p.m. today to local registrars. And I guess she has a week to get it into the Secretary of the Commonwealth. So we shall see if there's a hand count. A recount for that. And very tight race.
Yeah, very tight race, because that's a difference of somewhere in the neighborhood of 48 votes, as you say, in almost 7,000 votes cast. So that's very tight, yes.
Yeah. Well, actually, isn't it more like 15,000? They each got about 7,000.
Oh, okay. I see. Yes.
Yeah,
I think you're right. I'm sorry. I was looking at one side of the numbers there. Yes. Much, much smaller percentage that's separating them. Yeah. Let me just point to one other race. The Barnstable Board of Regional Commissioners, what we call the Barnstable County Commissioners, has two open seats. Plenty of familiar names on the ballot here advancing to November.
And it was an interesting primary because there's two open seats. So there were two Republicans running and there are two Democrats running. So all four of those candidates will advance to the November election, where the four of them will be competing for two open seats. So that remains to be seen. Of course, Mark Forrest and Sheila Lyons are the incumbents. And they did receive more votes in the primary, but we shall see what happens in the election in November.
And the Republican challengers?
Oh, they would be Ron Beatty Jr. and Cynthia Stead.
That is Denise Coffey of the Cape Cod Times with all the numbers and names. Denise, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
This is the News Roundup on the Point. I'm Steve Junker. We'll take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll speak to Sam Houghton on the Martha's Vineyard Times. Stay with us. This is the News Roundup on the Point. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with reporters and editors from around the region. I'm Steve Junker. News out yesterday that Oak Bluffs has apparently been the victim of a cyber crime. It's a developing story, and Sam Houghton of the Martha's Vineyard Times is here to explain what we know so far. Hi, Sam.
Hey, Steve.
What can you tell us? It seems the FBI is involved.
Yeah, we really don't know a lot, at least that we can confirm. But, right, the kind of the big things that we do know, there was a scam that the Oak Bluffs has been kind of a victim of, cyber scam. And right, the FBI is investigated. And we know they were hit about a week or two ago. But other than that, the town has been really quiet. We went to town hall, the police department, and spoke with officials there, and they wouldn't say anything. So, you know, obviously, when the FBI investigates something like this, everyone hushes up and we'll just wait and see what happens. So I guess we do know they're working with their insurance provider to help. So, to be seen. But I think it's interesting. I know the Independent, the Provincetown Independent, had an interesting story. And the town was hit by a scam there as well. And I thought really interesting.
It was Wellfleet. Wellfleet,
right.
Yep.
That story might not have come out if it wasn't for an audit of the town. It was, you know, a year later, and we kind of got an anonymous tip on this and looked into it and did confirm that it did happen. Mm. So it's interesting. You know, there might be a lot of these going on we just don't know about.
I want to ask you about another story that's drawing a number of comments from readers. Seems to have touched a nerve. People are reporting many insect bites on their ankles, and the culprit is uncertain. Maybe a tick larva, maybe also something called oak mites. Tell us what's going on.
Yeah, this is a pretty wild story. everyone's talking about it on the island. That's kind of why we dove into it. But it isn't just the ankles and feet, which is important. It's kind of the comments we're getting is all over people's bodies. But right, it is definitely catching fire a little bit. It was kind of the buzz in our newsroom this week. I think a few of us actually have it. So, but right, we treated this as kind of a mystery. We spoke with health officials on the island, and everyone's kind of pointing to Lone Star ticks, which are newish to the vineyard, and you know, not a great thing. They could lead to alpha gal, but those bites we are reporting are generally at the ankles and feet. And what people are experiencing now is really all over their bodies. Mm. And it's a lot of people. Part of our story is getting the word out there and to kind of gather feedback from what people are saying. And we've, you know, our inbox has been full with people writing in. But, you know, we kind of looked at, could this be what are called oak mites? And we found some research that shows that really the description that people are giving are do match that, but there's no report of an oak mite in New England. So it's kind of this mystery that we kind of dove into.
And then the fact that so many people are commenting and the comments definitely indicate that a lot of people are sort of not just scratching their heads, but scratching all parts of their bodies trying to figure this out.
Hey, yeah. And I think my favorite comment in this story, we've got a research someone is out in the field and he's experienced these bites in the last kind of 5 or 6 years. He doesn't know what they are, but I think one of the neatest things he kind of says, you know, people are assuming that they're oak mites, but common knowledge is often wrong about this stuff, just because this kind of incomplete information can really go viral. So we're not saying these are oak mites. But we have, you know, some, even the hospital is saying, yeah, possibly could be oak mites, these bites that we're seeing.
We have just about half a minute here, but I just want to point to you've got a great series that's ongoing that focuses on some of the history and people in the Brazilian immigrant connection with Martha's Vineyard. A nice profile right now of a fellow who worked for a long time on the vineyard and then returned to his life back in Brazil.
Yeah, this is Mr. Perez. We call him the legend. He's from this region of Brazil where really a lot of the region is immigrating. I think the community lost 15% of its population recently. And he was a very successful landscaper here on the island. And we kind of get into his story. And now he's kind of he gives advice to young Brazilians that are traveling to the island. But yeah, our series in general is just looking at it makes up such a big part of the island and how that started. We're looking into.
You can find that at the Martha's Vineyard Times website. Sam Houghton, thanks so much.
Thank you.
In a little more than a week, Chatham holds a special town meeting. A big waterfront project will be on the warrant. It's been the subject of plenty of scrutiny. Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle is here with details. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Steve.
Explain what this project is, and then we can talk about the kind of circuitous route that it's taken to get to this special town meeting.
Sure. The project involves a property that the town owns at 90 Bridge Street, which is on the Mitchell River and Stage Harbor. It's a small parcel, but it's been used for many years as sort of a commercial and recreational boating landing. The town is looking to enhance this property to accomplish a couple of different goals. One is to have more updated facilities for both recreational and commercial boaters. And the other is to relocate the town's shellfish growing facility, its upweller, to that property. Now that the upweller is currently located at the Harbor Master's office just down the road, but it's an old facility and not in the best spot for the health of the shellfish. So what this project will do is actually accomplish those goals plus some historic preservation by bringing a former historic Coast Guard boathouse that used to be on Stage Island across Stage Harbor from this location. And that's going to be put up on pilings over the water, and that will host the new upwelling facility for the town.
One of the folks quoted in your article says it's an economic project, it's a social project, it's a historical project, and a cultural project. So it really is wrapping its arms around a number of things. It's a big enough project that there's an $11 million price tag attached to it. Some of that money's already been appropriated or found in sources. Some of it the town is still looking for.
Exactly. Some of it has actually been spent because the project is underway at this moment. There's been a new bulkhead and riprap installed there to sort of beef up the property a little bit. But the money that's been expended so far and the money that's available for this project just aren't enough to cover the total cost, which, as you said, Steve, goes to about $11 million. Funding that's been expended so far came from an $11 million waterfront bond that the town passed a number of years ago. There's only about $2 million left in that fund, and this project needs about $6 million to be completed. So the town had put before voters in May a new $11 million waterfront bond, but that was rejected. And so town officials scrambled to try to save this Bridge Street project, and what they came up with was some additional funding from Waterways Improvement Fund and another $4 million ask that they'll be going to voters at the special town meeting on September 16th. Where the controversy comes in, there's a lot of support for this project in town, so it's not really the project that is causing some controversy here. It's the way that the town is going about financing it. After that town meeting vote in May failed, there was a ballot question on the subsequent town election to exempt that $11 million infrastructure bond, waterfront infrastructure bond, from Proposition 2.5. Now that passed, even though the town meeting vote hadn't passed. Selectmen and town officials are relying on the passage of that bond last May to authorize the expenditure of the additional $4 million should it pass at town meeting on next Monday. And a number of people, including members of the Finance Committee and some others, are saying, you know, that's just a sort of circuitous way of doing this, that the town should return to voters to get that bond authorization. And one of the reasons this is kind of a dangerous gamble by the town officials is that they relied on the same tactic for the Council on Aging funding a year ago. And when they went back to town meeting and asked for reauthorization of the Council on Aging funding, saying that, oh, we've already got the expenditure of the bond approved at the previous town election, the voters didn't buy that and they turned down the financing, the town meeting article. So there's a risk here that voters could say that, you know, you're doing this all wrong again, and we want another authorization of the bond rather than just relying on the previous one. So it's going to be interesting to see how that shakes out at town meeting, because on one hand, there is a lot of support for this project, but there's skepticism on the financing and even some of the financials on this project.
Voters
raised some questions.
Voters will get their say September 16th. It's Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks.
Thank you, Steve.
Stellwagen Bank National Marine Sanctuary exists out in the ocean off our coast. Its visitor center does not yet exist, but plans for it have been taking shape in Provincetown. Paul Benson of the Provincetown Independent joins us with the story. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Steve.
The select board here was presented with a proposed design for this visitor center. The select board had some concerns, but before we get there, maybe describe what we're talking about and where it might be located.
Right. So at the base of McMillan Pier, where there's a large town-owned parking lot, and then, you know, the town's main pier goes out into the harbor. It's where the ferries leave from, the whale watch boats, all the tourism, you know, fishing charters, and also Provincetown's fishing fleet, lobster boats and scallopers. So it's right in the middle of town at the junction of Lope Square and McMillan Pier.
And this building is, the select board saw proposed designs for this, and the people who are putting this together are right here. The Center for Coastal Studies is involved in this, right?
Yes. So the Center for Coastal Studies here in Provincetown really did a lot of the science that helped lead to the establishment of the Stellwagen Bank National Marine Sanctuary. And that's sort of the reason why the superintendent of the sanctuary said, this is our spiritual home. This is where Stellwagen was born. We want our visitor center here because our entire story about protecting this coastal or off-coast resource is involved with the science that happened here in Provincetown over the last several decades.
Tell us about the what was presented to the select board here and what their response was.
So 3 years ago, the select board had seen and had a discussion about locations for this, and they'd chosen right at the base of the pier. This was the first time there was a really, you know, a conceptual design presentation with a price tag on it. And the price tag was $21.3 million, and the feds have secured $15 million to build it. Somewhat unusually for a federal visitor center, this would be a town-owned building on town-owned land with the town responsible for maintaining it indefinitely. So the select board was worried about the cost. They were worried about the difference between 15 in the grant and 21.
Mm-hmm.
They were worried about whether that number was going to grow over time, the way every construction estimate seems to grow over time lately on Cape Cod. And they were worried about what their running costs were supposed to be into the future and how exactly they were supposed to ask voters to shoulder the burden of $6 million plus to build this federal building, a town building for a federal purpose.
And right. So they don't want to be left on the hook for running this building. But one of the concerns here also is about the size. Is that right?
Yeah. So because it's right at the base of the pier, that means it actually is in the FEMA velocity zone, which means wave action can impact the building and you have to raise it, you know, generally an extra 3 to 5 feet. So there are another location on the parking lot that is in the regular flood zone, but not the velocity zone. So it wouldn't have to be as high off the ground. This building, the first floor starts 9.5 feet off the ground. So, and then it's about 2 stories with a nice high atrium above that. So it's tall. And there were select board members who said, you know, if you moved it to the other side of the parking lot, you could probably have it look about a story shorter.
And that might also help with the cost, right? They're trying to they're encouraging the folks to sort of scale back this design and also try to meet the $15 million that they have in hand for it.
That's, I think, the predominant point of view was, regardless of where it's located, it should be smaller so that it can be cheaper. And they had a visitation analysis that said about 250,000 people a year would visit this building, and they would almost all be in July and August. So this is the size it needs to be. And they sort of encouraged them to be like, well, why don't you look at what a smaller version of this would look like, and then what a smaller version of it would cost, and we can see if it fits in what the taxpayers might be willing to do.
Where does it go from here now? Are they're going to take this feedback from the board and sort of look at the project again?
I think so. There's a note in our coming select board packet that says, will you please put in writing what it is that we understood, which is you're interested in these two sites. We don't need to look elsewhere in town. And we'll do design revisions based on that. So presuming that goes the way it looks like what they said a week ago, yeah, the feds would have the job of reevaluating the size of the building and seeing if they can get the cost closer to $15 million total.
It's Paul Benson of the Provincetown Independent, where you can find the story. Paul, thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve.
You're listening to the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll hear from Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Stay with us. This is the Local News Roundup on the Point. I'm Steve Junker. We are talking about the top local stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. At least one member of Nantucket's Historic District Commission thinks that body can't do its job right now because commission members are too fearful of being sued over their decisions. Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror joins us with this story. Hi, Josh.
Good morning.
The case in point here, which seems to get referred to again and again, is the Sparks Avenue development, also called the New Downtown. Tell us how these two stories kind of come together here.
Sure. That is pretty much, it is certainly a talking point and one of a number of examples that HDC member Val Oliver refers to, certainly one of the more recent ones. Another is a rather large-scale commercial building proposed for a little bit further out in the Mid-Island for a carpenter shops and some apartments that she doesn't feel is within the scale of what it should be either. But really the overarching concern among several people, including Val Oliver, is that the looming prospect of developers suing the town for denying an application is holding too much weight with some of the town's regulatory boards. Oliver said she thinks that board members are more concerned at times with avoiding a lawsuit than making sure an application is up to par and meets the town standards, and builders are taking advantage of that. And it's she says it's become a standard she's uncomfortable with. She says that property owners certainly have rights, but they also have an obligation, if they want to be on Nantucket and build on Nantucket, to build and design what's appropriate for the island. And again, her concerns sort of came to light again last week when the Historic District Commission approved the so-called new downtown development on Sparks Avenue by a 3-2 vote. Those who voted against it felt that it is still a little bit too large, too much massing, not appropriate for the neighborhood, but it did pass. Sort of countering what Val Oliver is saying is Planning Board Chairman David Iverson, who says he sees things differently. He said he's not afraid of being sued. He just doesn't want to blur the lines between what island regulatory boards can and cannot demand of developers. If a suit were to happen in one of these cases, he said, a judge would likely rule in favor of the developers and grant them additional rights, which would be counterproductive for slowing the rate of development on the island. And that's something he said he'd rather avoid. He points to the fact that at the end of the day, property rights established by the town zoning bylaw dictate what can and cannot be built and what the regulatory boards have to go on. And their job is to ensure that projects are suitable for the island by imposing conditions and revisions when they can. And if the voters want to change the look or the feel or the development rate, they can do that by potentially changing the zoning bylaw, but they can't demand that the town's regulatory boards do it arbitrarily outside the bounds of the existing zoning bylaw.
Such an interesting discussion about how these decisions are made. You have another story out this morning that also points towards this contention around development, but this is kind of an amazing story, I have to say. It's an account of one of the more dramatic-sounding ZBA meetings that I can remember hearing about, with accusations flying in multiple directions. This happened just last night. Tell us about this.
It did, and this is in regard to a very controversial project that has been being discussed for over 5 years now, the Surfside Crossing 40B project that is currently proposed as 156 condominium units on about 13 acres just off of Surfside Road on South Shore Road. And it was back before the ZBA last night after a judge sent it back to the ZBA, overturning the State Housing Appeals Court's decision to allow the 156 condominium units after a lengthy public hearing process that lasted almost 3 years here on Nantucket, wrapped up about 2 years ago. The judge said that after the zoning board turned down the request for 156 units as part of the 40B process, the developers went to the Housing Appeals Committee, said they needed to build it that large to make it viable. The Housing Appeals Committee agreed. They also changed the makeup, the developers changed the makeup of that development from mixed-use residential units and condominiums to all condominiums. Judge said that's outside the scope, has to go back to ZBA, and that's why the fireworks started last night. There were accusations of conflict of interest from all sides. Attorney Paul Durensis, representing a number of neighbors, asked the chair to recuse herself and pause the hearing because of a pending ethics complaint against the ZBA by his client, Megan Perry. She argued that the ZBA signed off on an acknowledgement of an agreement that there was no pending litigation against the project when there happened to be at the time. The attorney for the developer said, no, all the ZBA did was sign off and acknowledge that the project met the requirements of the comprehensive permit that was issued for it. There were also a number of other complaints lodged and accusations made. A ZBA member who has voted against the project in the past asked that the independent counsel be appointed for the ZBA because town council's George Pucci was serving two different masters, both the ZBA and the select board, and he didn't feel that was appropriate. Pucci took great exception to that, and it kind of went on from there. And this is only the first meeting in what it promises probably to be several meetings of this proposal, again, to build 156 condominium units for the Surfside Crossing project.
That's Josh Bowling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Josh, thanks for keeping track of all that for us. And you can find that article on the website. Josh, we'll talk to you.
Sounds good.
Massachusetts voters went to the polls for the state primary this week, and state employees are still waiting for raises that were approved by the state legislature earlier this year. CAI's Gilda Geist talked about these stories and more with our State House correspondent, Katie Lannon. Here's their conversation.
Hey, Gilda. Good morning.
We had our state primary here in Massachusetts this week, and we heard it was going to be a relatively quiet election. Can you give us a sense of what turnout was like?
Yeah, I think the thing to know is that it overall was exactly that, a quiet election with few contested races going into it. State officials were projecting a turnout of around 15%, which, you know, is not high when you're looking at out of 100. It does compare favorably to some other years when the presidential election was really kind of the focus of the action electorally. We won't know finalized numbers for a while, but it's probably, when you look at the mail-in voting, that seemed to drive a lot of the turnout that way, and that was below that 15% number. So we'll see ultimately how many people did turn out in person on election day who were motivated by maybe some local races and things of interest in their particular geographic region. I know there were a few open seats on the Cape when it comes to state house elections, and those smaller, more down ballot races might have been the thing that ended up driving turnout this time around.
And so probably the highest profile contested race was the Republican primary for the U.S. Senate. And the winner of that race will face off with Senator Elizabeth Warren in November. What do we know about her Republican challenger?
So the winner of that race was John Deaton, a lawyer who's probably best known for his advocacy around cryptocurrency. He came out on top in a three-man primary. And as you say, will now face off against Elizabeth Warren in November. Deaton spent heavily to get to this point from both his own money, and there's been outside groups spending on his behalf. We know that he, relatively new to Massachusetts, having moved here last year from Rhode Island, he's touted a background as someone who grew up in childhood poverty, overcame abuse, addiction, cancer, and became a Marine and graduated from law school. So he's touting his story as kind of the American dream, and in rhetoric that's similar to some language we often hear from Warren, as someone who can fight for the little guy. So that'll be an interesting race as we head into these next 2 months till election day.
And so moving along to some of the other stories this week, it looks like public employees across the state are waiting for their collective bargaining agreements to be approved by the legislature. And so what does this mean for these employees?
Yeah, these are public workers, everyone from community college faculty and staff to nurses and other healthcare workers who staff state agencies, waiting on their raises. The funding for those union contracts is tied up in a spending bill that the House and Senate lawmakers have really left on ice for several weeks now. It's something that Governor Healey first asked the legislature to approve in March, and here we are now in September with these folks whose money, whose raises are tied up in this bill, still waiting. It's not the first time we've seen talks kind of drag on as lawmakers consider these spending bills. But interestingly, we don't know where negotiations stand. It's being done kind of quietly between the House and the Senate, so we're not sure what a holdup might be.
And so it looks like Uber and Lyft drivers rallied in Boston to mark the official launch of their campaign in support of Question 3. Can you tell us a little bit more about this ballot measure and what its passage would mean for Uber and Lyft drivers?
Yeah, this would allow those drivers to unionize, a right that many other workers, but not gig economy workers in Massachusetts, have. They're saying in their supporters, like State Attorney General Andrea Campbell, Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley, say that it would help them fight for better rights and benefits. Now, this does come after a settlement Campbell reached with those big rideshare companies that raises the minimum pay level for Uber and Lyft drivers. And it'll be interesting to see as we come to the ballot this fall if voters really have an appetite for maybe expanding those benefits further if they're still thinking about working conditions. There's not an official opposition campaign organized yet, but there are some folks who worry about how this would interact with federal labor laws and potentially open up the possibility for a legal challenge.
Katie Lannon from the State House, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And that is CAI's Gilda Geist speaking with our State House reporter, Katie Lannon. You're listening to the local news roundup on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. Provincetown is getting a $1 million grant to improve sewer infrastructure. CAI's Eve Zukoff says the town sought the funds after a sewer emergency 2 years ago, something many of us remember all too vividly. Eve joins us now. Hi, Eve.
Hi.
Remind us of what happened in 2022 to give us a sense of why the town really wanted these funds.
Yeah, lots of folks will remember this. Business owners, locals, even some of the vacationers. Because basically, 2 years ago, the sewer system's critical central vacuum system malfunctioned. And that's just because of heavy rain. It caused a failure in the electrical panel. Basically, it led to sewage backups in 30 homes. It forced commercial street businesses to shut down for 48 hours. I was talking to town officials about this week. They said they had PTSD reviewing some of the calls they had to go through.
And it happened in August. A terrible moment to have sewage. I mean, there's no great moment for sewage, but still, it's the hot, busy moment in around here.
They said they remember it being in the middle of Bear Week. So just so many people here and a bunch of issues really from a commercial street from Snow Street to Point Street and properties on the sewer system on Bradford between Conwell Street and Prince Street. I mean, it was a major interruption, and it was actually the second time in 13 years that sewage spilled into homes and streets due to a system failure.
So it's nothing funny about this. What will these funds do here?
Yeah, so these funds are coming from the state's Municipal Vulnerability Preparedness Program, MVP. They're going to go towards newer pumps, updated technology, and they will help move the electrical infrastructure, that critical stuff, to the second floor of a building from the first floor of a building where they are now to make it more resilient to flooding. Because right now the concern is when we have a major storm, flooding will do this all over again. And it's really important here because Provincetown is working to move away from septic systems to rely entirely on a sewer system from wastewater by 2030.
So good news there for Provincetown and its sewering effort. Let's talk about another Outer Cape story that you covered this week. You spent a few hours with Gordo Miller, a lifeguard who for 40 years has been protecting beachgoers on the Outer Cape. Tell us a little bit about him.
Yeah, Gordon Miller. Okay, where do we begin? On paper, he is the North District Lifeguard Supervisor for Cape Cod National Seashore. He oversees 20 lifeguards across three beaches, and he himself is head guard at Herring Cove on Tuesdays. And so that's kind of, you know, his stats. But then when you get to know him, you learn immediately about him that he's just got this massive laugh. He was kind of breaking my microphone in the best way. But he's also incredibly modest. He's a great storyteller. And he's one of these people who just embodies what career he's chosen. He came to Cape Cod at 23 to be a lifeguard and says not only does he love it, but he just never wanted to get a real job. And this is perfect for him.
There's so many interesting things in your conversation with him that come out, I thought. One of them is that he comes not from the ocean. He really discovered the ocean as a young person and has made it his life's calling.
Yeah, he grew up in rural Tennessee to a family of eight brothers and sisters. Didn't see the ocean until he was 19. He was working a summer job at Acadia National Park, and he says that it was a cellular connection. There had been a pain behind his head his whole life that released, went away forever when he felt this presence. And now he's on Cape Cod in the summers, and he spends his winters in Hawaii. That's how much the ocean means to him.
So I've got to ask, he's been here for 40 years now. He's 63. Is retirement on the horizon?
I asked this. He said, never. It was just a big laugh. Never. He said that, you know, his fitness is as good as it was when he was 40. He can tell because he has to do a 600-yard run, 600-yard swim, half-mile run before the start of each season. He does it at the same time, basically, 23 years ago. So he will be around for as long as he can do that.
You were out there on the beach with him. Does it make you feel better knowing he's out there?
Oh, my gosh. I am going to be swimming out as far as I can. No, I'm not going to do that because he says don't because of the sharks. But no, he is the kind of person that makes you feel good to live on Cape Cod.
That is CAI's Eve Zukoff. You can find her profile of Gordon Miller on our website, capeandislands.org. Thanks, Eve.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. I want to thank all my guests. We heard from CAI's Jeanette Barnes. We heard from Denise Coffey of the Cape Cod Times and Sam Houghton of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle and Paul Benson of the Provincetown Independent, and Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. CAI's Gilda Geist spoke with our State House correspondent Katie Lannon and CAI's Eve Zuckoff there. Big thanks to Dan Treadle for engineering the program. Little known fact about Dan, he can recite the legal ID backward. Nantucket 1.91 NANW Brewster 3. I can't do it, but he can. In Woods Hole, I'm Steve Junker. Thank you. Talk to you next week. Thank you.